Hi folks, welcome to episode 13 of Epochs of Lotus Eaters. This week I'm joined by Beau, because every week I'm joined by Beau, but that's a good thing. Because this week we're going to be talking about the mighty army of the King of Kings of Persia. You looked unimpressed there. Xerxes the Great, the invader of Greece. And before we go on, right, I think that we just need to take a moment to recognize that Xerxes won the Persian invasion of Greece. Right, people don't seem to remember, and because of course everything's we read about it is from the Greek perspective, and so there's the heroic resistance. But from the Persian perspective, Xerxes just raised a massive army, marched into Greece, raised Athens, and then sailed home. Like, that was his mission, and he did it.
Well, there was the engagement at Salamis.
Sure.
And Battle of Plataea.
Yeah, I'm not saying that he pacified all of Greece or anything, right, okay. But that wasn't his goal.
Right, yeah.
It was the slave, remember the Athenians. Okay, what about the Athenians? Well, I'm going to go in there and level their city. And he did. Yeah. So, you know, just saying, Xerxes undefeated. Anyway, so Xerxes, for the great invasion, now this took a long time to come about, didn't it? Because this all comes from the Athenians burning Sardis, because the Ionians are under the Persian yoke. They were related to the Athenians, being Ionians, and they wanted freedom. And the Persians said no, and the Athenians said yes. There was a minor kerfuffle at Sardis. Someone set something on fire, and then that caused Xerxes to be like, right, okay, I may be ruling a world-spanning empire, but that tiny city over there, around the border of the known world, I'm going to deal with that. And so every day he had a slave whisper in his ear, remember the Athenians, he sat down to dinner or something, wasn't it? And so he ends up raising what was obviously a giant army of some kind, although the numbers are, of course, disputed. We'll talk about that at some point, I'm sure. And he marches across the Bosporus. He builds a bridge across the Bosporus, marches this gargantuan army that we're told drinks rivers dry into Greece, have a bit of a sort of three-day stoppage with a bunch of Spartans and Thespians and Thebans at Thermopylae. And then he continues on and burns Athens and goes home, which is a summary of it,
yeah,
basically. Right, so... So Xerxes, right? He's basically, as far as I can tell from reading the histories of the time, he's basically the ruler of the known world, isn't he?
Yeah, to a degree. Yeah, in their mind.
Yeah.
There's not. It's the fringes of the known world that are left to be subdued.
Yeah.
Because the Ionian and the Greek world, the Peloponnesian world, is on the fringes as far as he's concerned.
Yeah, and from the perspective of the Greeks, they don't know how big Asia is. They don't know how far the Persian dominions extend to the east. They just know that everything across the water is Persian, and that's as far as it goes. And so when you've got Xenophon marching back through the Persian Empire, they just can't believe how far they've got to travel and the size of the cities that they're encountering. And then, oh my God, this is colossal. So you can't really overstate Xerxes' reputation and power in the Greek mind, right? Mm. I mean, they are well aware that the Persians are a terrifying force.
Yeah. No, absolutely huge and just innumerable.
Yes.
Just there's no end to them. Mm. There's no end to their money, to their horses, to their men.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Alexander in the 300s BC, so a good 150 years after Herodotus at least, where he really he finds out the extent of Asia, or he doesn't even find the end, of course. But in the age of Herodotus, they would have known a lot less than that. There's one thing you said right there that I thought was interesting about Sardis, because when Alexander, for example, burns down Persepolis, at the end of the Persian Empire, a lot of the justification for it is, well, you destroyed Athens, you invaded Greece, but it didn't start there. In Book 7 of Herodotus, which is where nearly all this comes from, there's a line where I can't remember if it's actually Xerxes himself says it. I think it is, but he says that they were the ones that fired Sardis and invaded Asia.
Yeah.
So. Whether that was in response to something the Persians did, I don't know. I'm not sure. But it's difficult to say who started it.
Well, really. I think. I mean, you could put the onus on the Persians originally by saying, well, they conquered the Ionians, and the Ionians had a just cause to demand their liberty,
right?
Which is fair, and the Athenians were supporting that, and that's what the burning of Sardis was about. That's fair, but I think from the Persian perspective, it's not persuasive. We don't care.
Yeah.
We're the masters of the world. Just give us your earth and water and we'll move on.
I think maybe it is worth just mentioning the geography and things, that the Ionian coast, the west coast of Turkey, nominally Persian land, or there was sort of a Persian satrap there and everything, but there's lots of Greek settlements there. I mean, including Halicarnassus, which is where Herodotus is from.
Yes, indeed.
So he knew that part of the world very well. I mean, intimately, that was where he's from.
Yeah.
And so that's really where the Persian and the Greek world sort of intersect, is there on the Ionian coast, the west coast of Turkey, Asia Minor. As far as Xerxes is concerned, there's a bit actually in Book 7 where he mentions, it's actually Darius, the ruler directly before Xerxes, because Xerxes is quite young, isn't he? Darius dies sort of unexpectedly of natural causes. Mm. And the fairly young Xerxes comes into the throne. And there's a bit where he mentions all the different peoples. I mean, 47 different peoples.
Yeah, nations.
And stretching, he mentions the Scythians. And then mentioning all the way out to India and the Libyans, the Arabians, lots and lots. There's lists, more than one time. There's a fair few lists of different peoples. Mm. And on their sort of western fringe are these sort of troublesome Greeks that they're wary of, but also pretty quite confident they're going to smash them in if they really put their minds to it. Marathon was a one-off. Yeah. Or maybe we should mention that real quick, that the Persian ruler before Xerxes was Darius, and he tried to invade Greece and was turned back at Marathon
by the Athenians alone, which was one of the glories of Athens, actually. See, it's hard for... I'm trapped in a position. Do I simp for Athens or do I simp for the Persians? I like simping for both of these. So
I think at Marathon, I can't help but root for the Greeks.
Yeah,
I just can't help it. It's like a 1066 thing. I can't root for the Normans. Yeah. I just can't bring myself to do it.
No, I'm with you.
Although I've got respect for them. But at Marathon, it was completely against the odds. They were massively outnumbered, at least on paper, outclassed, maybe. I mean, the heavy Greek hoplites are really quite something to contend with. But they turned them back at the beach. The Athenians decided they would meet the Persian ships as they landed on the beach at Marathon. And big battle there, wave after wave, pushed back. And it really is quite glorious. It's one of those things, it's difficult to see it, unless you are Iranian or Persian. It's difficult to see it as anything other than glorious, really.
I think it would be, you'd be, even if you're an Iranian patriot, you'd be hard-pressed not to give respect to the Athenians for this victory. Because, I mean, the Persians, again, like these are the best in the ancient Near Eastern world. You know, this is why they have the giant empire. They outnumber the Athenians something like 3-1. And the Athenians only had footmen, only had hoplites. And so all they could do is charge at the Persians. And that's what they did. And they won. And that's an impressive thing. But anyway, right. So the Persians have had a few dalliances trying to come across. And then Darius does come over, subdues sort of like Thrace and Macedon, and then goes and fights the Scythians. But that doesn't go brilliantly. And he's got the help of the Ionians during that, hasn't he, in fact? But then afterwards, there's the Ionian revolt. And Xerxes is like, right, I'm going to come and deal with this. And so he raises all of Asia against Europe.
Yeah, and takes him years, it says, 4 years, or it's only in the fifth year that he is sort of ready to go.
Yeah.
And it says somewhere as well that he spends 3 years making, getting all the provisions together for it, because that's a big thing. If we're going to talk in detail about the numbers involved, a lot of people say it can't be that huge because just the amount of water and fodder you need for the animals and all the food for the men. Well, if you spent 3 years getting it together and put together, huge depots, Herodotus doesn't give us great detail, but he does say the Persians took years to get this thing ready. Yeah.
Just before we start, right, so the Persian Empire, as Xerxes takes over, it begins in sort of Thrace in the east, goes all the way down the coast of the Mediterranean, the eastern coast of the Mediterranean, includes Egypt, everything across to the west, across sort of northern Arabia, the Fertile Crescent, Iran, like undeterminate sort of areas north of that, but there's definitely something that they own there, and then all the way over to the sort of borders of India, right? And so I've seen estimates that the Persian Empire could have contained some upwards of 50-60 million people in it. So one of the things that I constantly am railing against with modern historians is they're deflating of numbers. I'm constantly sick of them going, oh, it couldn't have been a million men because, you know, that would be ridiculous. It's like, yeah, well, if anyone could raise a million men, it's Xerxes. You know, and so he's probably the only person on Earth, or maybe in China they could have done something similar, but like the only person in this area of the world who could have raised a million men would be Xerxes. And so it's not impossible. It's not physically impossible for him to have literally just pulled all those up out of the ground and then brought them to one place. So whether he did or not, of course, we don't know. But anyway, I just think it's plausible.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely plausible. I would say it's plausible. But the numbers, when we get into the detail of the numbers, they vary wildly, hugely. I mean, even Herodotus contradicts himself. I think, although it's not the upper limit of the numbers aren't impossible, there's doubt, sure, at least in my mind, but it's certainly possible. It's a giant empire. I mean, he's sort of a king of kings, isn't he? So, since Cyrus and Darius the First, it's kind of gone from strength to strength. Some people that are real experts on the Persian Empire might disagree with what I'm about to say, but I feel like under Xerxes the Great, it's sort of at one of its zeniths. It feels like to me. His accession was relatively smooth.
Yeah.
So he didn't have to have tons of civil wars in order to secure his throne. Mm-hmm. I mean, because the previous ruler, Darius, dies of basically natural causes, but it seems like he had been planning to bounce back into Greece. Yeah. Yeah. He didn't want to let it lie at Marathon.
Yeah.
He wasn't going to have that. But it also seems, one of the things I'd say is that Xerxes doesn't seem like it's his entire be all and end all. No. So, for example, it springs to mind that when Henry V became king, it was like the first thing he wanted to do, and the only thing he wanted to do, was have a war with France and jump into France and have a war there. It doesn't seem like that's really how Xerxes thought about it. Like, first of all, Herodotus tells us that
remind him constantly that the Athenians need to be taught a lesson.
Right, yeah, it feels like they're buzzing around on the peripheries of his consciousness, and he may or may not do something about it. It feels like that at first.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, if you've got to have someone remind you that they're the problem, then they're probably not the problem.
Right, right, yeah.
Like, this is about Xerxes' honour at this point.
You know, and it's not like we're in the age of Alexander, where they've got a big army and a political will to come and invade him. Yeah. Nothing like that.
Oh, no.
So he doesn't have to do it if he didn't want to.
Yeah, the Greeks are not united. They cannot raise, like, you know, 50,000 men or something like that. They can't do that. You know, that's at the very end at Plataea. Herodotus tells us they have about 100,000 men, which is about 38,000 hoplites and then 60,000 light armed troops, and that's to defeat the 300,000 men we're told Xerxes leaves behind to pacify Greece. And that's the sort of high watermark of Greek forces in the field, really. You know, I don't think they ever actually muster that number of men again. I mean, Alexander takes 50,000, doesn't he?
Yeah, to begin with. Yeah, that's right.
You know,
yeah.
So
maybe even less.
So, this is like all of Greece, or like the huge numbers of Greeks coming together to actually resist a foreign invader. But like, anyway, the Persians have got a huge army.
I think it's interesting that the Persians seem to think they really do concentrate on the Athenians. They don't talk about, let's defeat the Peloponnesians, let's defeat the Greeks or anything. They talk about the Athenians.
Yeah.
We're going to go get the Athenians.
Yeah. Yeah, I love
which I think is funny. But there are actually quite a lot of Greek allies that fight with the Persians.
There are.
Thebans, the Boeotians, and there's a fair few.
Yeah, there are lots of traitors, aren't they, to the Athenians. What amazes me, though, is that more Greeks didn't hang the Athenians out to dry. Like, I always find this really bizarre, but like, if you're a Greek, you just look around and be like, right, everything's fairly settled with the Spartans. You know, they're not actually, you know, very interesting, to be honest. But Athens, every time Athens, it's always Athens. It's like, you know, like the Simpsons or something. Every time something goes, it's Bart. He's like, they're like the Bart Simpson of the ancient Greek world. Whatever the trouble is, what's that? The thousand nations of the Persian Empire are descending on Greece? Oh, what did Athens do now?
Yeah.
You know, that's the, you know, it's the Athenians that have caused this.
Yeah.
Anyway.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.